This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
A lot has changed in the past year. How we work, the people we can and can't see, and how we grieve.
Collectively, we are experiencing this very much together in this moment. However, we are also doing so when we are all socially isolated and distanced.
Also today, 10 years after one of the world's worst nuclear disasters, artists reached out to young people in Japan and asked a question.
What's on your mind right now?
What's on my mind right now? My ability to continue with my studies.
And how British do you have to be in Britain? Some popular immigrant musicians are finding out the hard way during award season.
You're not deemed worthy of even being considered.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It is good to be with you today. Tomorrow, it'll be 1 year that World Health Organization Director Tedros Ghebreyesus made the official declaration.
Pandemic is not a word to use lightly or carelessly.
For 12 months, we've been living with the word pandemic and its reality. More than 2.6 million people dead and 117 million infected because of the coronavirus. The planet continues to battle the acute phase of the pandemic and what Ghebreyesus recently called mass trauma. As we hear from the world's Ilana Gordon, psychologists say the trauma will have impacts for years to come.
Christy Denklis sees a paradox.
Collectively, we are experiencing this very much together in this moment. However, we are also doing so when we are all socially isolated and distanced.
Collectively together, and yet collectively, totally alone. Denkla is a clinical psychologist and global health researcher at Harvard. She says the pandemic has even disrupted how we mourn.
People grieve very differently. Everyone grieves so differently. Some people grieve very publicly. Some people grieve very privately. Sometimes we do a little bit of both. It's a mixed process. So there's really no one right way to do it.
Denkla says rituals are essential to be able to begin to acknowledge the reality of the losses. A lot of that has gone virtual this year. She says it's too soon to understand the impacts, but she is worried. Digitally connecting doesn't replace in-person connections.
Grief alone is very painful, and we are not meant to grieve alone. And we are forced now to grieve alone, oftentimes in isolation.
It's a lot. There's the losses from the pandemic, and then other losses where grieving was interrupted by the pandemic itself. In the U.S., Black, Latino, and other vulnerable communities are already carrying a bigger weight of these losses.
And this is happening against a backdrop of compounded stressors. So we're sort of in a perfect storm. We worry for downstream, clinically impairing conditions. And what I really worry about is the impact on the most vulnerable among us.
All this means the impact of the pandemic and the collective trauma could last for years. WHO Emergency Operations Manager Mike Ryan recently stressed that this sense of loss can't be any one individual's burden to carry. Mental health systems are maxed out.
I think there's a point where it just becomes unethical to continue to call something out as an issue, but not actually focus on solutions.
Solutions, for Joyal Mulheron, means reimagining the whole system for addressing bereavement, making it more holistic. She's director of Evermore, a nonprofit that focuses on improving conditions for families.
You know, bereaved siblings are at higher risk of premature death, dropping out of high school, or teen pregnancy. Bereaved children experience higher rates of depression. There's a lack of understanding that the systems around the families can facilitate helpful coping, functional coping, or make coping all that more difficult and complicated.
Mulheron says policies can make a difference, like employment and housing protections, benefit transfers, psychosocial supports, things that just aren't a guarantee right now. Christy Denkla at Harvard is deeply worried too, She also says it's important to remember, when you're into this pandemic, that humans are resilient. Acknowledging the loss and stress is a first step. And yet, she says, there also might be another paradox in this moment, perhaps a more optimistic one.
It's almost psychologically impossible to truly process and absorb this without hindsight, without some distance.
Dankla says many may be feeling numb to the magnitude of losses in this moment. In some instances, that can actually help.
It can provide a buffer. It can help us get through a very demanding time. And then when we have the space, we might go back and start to process.
But in the meantime, she really hopes that these overdue collective conversations about grief and loss could lead to long-term support for everyone who's grieving. For The World, I'm Alana Gordon.
The pandemic has also changed many of our rituals. For Mark Stober, the lead chaplain at Addenbrookes Hospital in Cambridge in the UK, poetry has been a way to navigate the challenges. Mark, what has the last year been like for you? I mean, you've been a chaplain for more than 20 years. I imagine you've seen some things in the last 12 months you never thought you'd see.
Yeah, I have. What we've been experiencing is that this kind of COVID trauma, if that's what I want to call it, has been experienced across the whole hospital and across great swathes of people and in communities, and there's kind of no escape from it.
So poetry, it's art via words. Why did you turn to poetry?
I've always used poetry different ways. I think one of the philosophers, the great Heinrich Zimmer, said the greatest things can't be told. The next best are the thoughts about the great things, or what we say about the thoughts about the great things. I kind of paraphrase that by saying great things can't be told. The next best are exclamations of the great things. For me, poetry lies at that expression, that exclamatory sense of what it is to live in these weird times.
So I'm wondering if you could read part of a poem you wrote called The Slow Questions.
The slow, slow questions wait in hiding. They wait until they perceive that once exposed in the open, they won't be dropped or damaged. Even a space open between will suffice only after delicate testing. Emerging from the shadows, the slow, slow questions search for somewhere to alight, a bird flying to a perch and sing its song. Does it matter that the song is not replied to? Slow, slow questions sing as sing they must. The reply? Ah. The slow, slow, slower answers reach and embrace the questions not with words, not in song, but as dance, a dance of love.
So explain what the slow questions are and why you wrote this.
Slow questions are questions that don't have fast answers. I was actually in a seminar when I wrote it, when I heard another chaplain speak about how she creates safe space and place so that her patients can ask slow questions. And I was thinking about all those existential questions that people ask. Why me? Who am I? About mortality. And often the questions are asked, sometimes in fear of what the answer might be, but they can only be asked when it's safe to ask, and there's an invitation. And that's sort of where my practice as a chaplain lies.
How does it help us during a pandemic?
Because I think the questions about who we are as human beings and about mortality and about the nature of existence are in our faces constantly. And finding a place to ask the questions is really important. And in the midst of trauma, the sense that the questions won't be answered with words is also important. It just creates an opening, a safe, a compassionate space in the midst of chaos.
So, Mark, we've been living with this pandemic for a year now. We've seen the graphs go up, down, up again, and now down again. We've stayed away from family and friends. We've watched as others have downplayed or even denied the pandemic. What does this moment mean now for you? What have you learned?
I think it's the universality of it. None of us can get away from it. But what I think is happens in this moment is, in the midst of trauma, trauma shatters the narratives by which we live by. And what do we do when that happens? We theologically, we replace them possibly with the poetic expression, but also it's the human touch, of what we give to each other in the darkness. But because it's happened universally, I think individually we may find we've got to find a new narrative, but collectively as a society, we'll also have to find a new narrative that fits better. And that's what's made it quite different. And I think we're going to take a while before we get those sorts of narratives. And they won't come from up there and out there. They'll come from amongst us as we are able to articulate and express what it is to be human beings living in together in compassion.
Mark Stobert, lead chaplain at Adam Brooks Hospital in Cambridge in the UK. Thank you very much for speaking with us and sharing your poetry a year into this pandemic.
You're welcome. Thank you for the opportunity.
We've reported a lot on the show about getting the coronavirus vaccine out to some of the world's most vulnerable populations, like people in cramped refugee camps. Zaatari in Jordan, for example, is the largest refugee camp in the Middle East. About 80,000 Syrians who fled their country's war live there, and they're getting vaccinated. Dr. Ahmad Bawaneh is the Jordan director at International Medical Corps. They've been assisting the Jordanian government and the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees with vaccination drives in the camps. Dr. Jordan launched the world's first vaccination drive for refugees back in January. 2 months later, how would you say it's going along?
Well, overall, I think we are achieving together with all of other partners here great achievements and the progress toward the plan. So far, I think people are accepting the vaccine, and we see great acceptance so far in comparison with the day that we started.
And in terms of numbers, how many vaccinations a day are we talking about?
So far, there are more than 450 people from big refugee camps received the vaccine. And still also, on a daily basis, there are more people getting the vaccine.
Compared to the 80,000 people who are in the camp, it doesn't sound like you're very far along with vaccinations. What is the goal, to vaccinate everybody there?
Yes, it's true that it's a kind of a slow start, but we need just always to consider that as everywhere else, people they are still learning about the process. They are still learning about how much this is important for their lives. And I have to be frank here that we are taking a lot of efforts now with other organizations to spread the positive messages around the vaccine. And as everywhere else, people, they are receiving also conflicting messages. And our role mainly is to try and explain for the people how important to get the vaccine.
So, Doctor, what about the hundreds of thousands of other refugees outside the camps? Because many are in temporary housing, but still displaced outside their country with many of the disadvantages that brings. Are they getting vaccinated now?
Yes, they do, because they are getting the registration on the platform. And, of course, it's their right, and they are prioritized according to the health conditions and, of course, the age, just like the Jordanian and everyone else.
So Jordan may be the first country to include refugees in the initial vaccination process, but other places have since vowed to do the same. What does that tell you?
I think it's one of the lessons that we learned in this situation, that we need to look into this crisis as kind of something that we need to face all together. And the only way to get out of it is not to leave anyone behind. So it doesn't matter if it's if I'm a refugee or if I'm from the same country or if I'm a visitor. I think the only way to face the challenge is to get everyone vaccinated. I think the government here, they are doing their best, and they are trying to enroll everyone in this program and trying to get them vaccinated. So I think it's a great effort by everyone. It's very important.
Dr. Ahmad Bawaneh is the Jordan director at International Medical Corps. They've been assisting the Jordanian government and the UNHCR in facilitating the vaccination drive in refugee camps. Dr. Bawaneh, thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much.
There is nearly $2 trillion in the U.S. stimulus package, some of it for children in poverty. Just ahead, how that money stacks up against similar programs in other countries. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It is one of the biggest federal aid deals since the Great Depression, and this afternoon the House voted yes on it, $1.9 trillion. We want to focus on just one part of it, the child benefit that will give most American families a guaranteed monthly income of up to $300 per child. The Biden administration says the goal here is to reduce child poverty. Many other industrialized countries already do something similar. Luke Schaefer is the director of Poverty Solutions at the University of Michigan. I asked him about the range of countries around the globe that already have some sort of guaranteed monthly income for families.
There's a lot of countries that do this already, some for decades. So Canada, Austria, Denmark, France, Germany, Australia. These are countries that have decided that, hey, you know, raising kids is expensive and the government has a reason to support parents in that work.
So how long have these programs been around?
Programs like this have been around for at least half a century, but you've seen an expansion of some of them in recent years in the countries that look most like us. In Canada, they did a major expansion just in the last decade and have one quite a bit larger than what we're talking about in the United States, and have seen really big poverty reductions and a lot of other positive things happen. In the United Kingdom, they had an expansion of the child benefit, along with a lot of other things, in the 1990s, and they cut their child poverty rate in half.
So in a few sentences, Luke, how would the child allowance in the Biden stimulus plan actually work? Like, start with who gets it.
The great thing about this is that it would treat families, middle-class families and working poor families and very poor families exactly the same. It would be a tax credit, but it'd be something that would be administered monthly. So families could count on $250 per child, $300 per young child under six for every month. And this would be money that they could use to pay the rent. It could be money that they could use to put food on the table, but it also could be money they use to pay for childcare and sometimes maybe make it possible for a parent to go to work.
So as you said, the UK put a similar policy in place in the late 90s. It's been expanded and it's been successful at reducing child poverty. Can you tell us how that worked and how does it compare to this plan from the Biden White House?
In some ways, what the UK did in the 1990s looks a lot more like the system that we would have today. So they said during the 1990s, we really want to have a dramatic impact on child poverty in this country. But they layered on a bunch of different things. One was this sort of stable source of support in the form of a child benefit. But they also had a benefit that looks like our earned income tax credit in this program that says if you work more, actually at low levels, we're going to increase that support. And that's really important because what we know about a lot of the programs that we have in the United States, the ones that exist, are that as your earnings go up, your benefits go down, right? So if you go to work, for every dollar you earn, you're going to lose 30 cents of your food assistance, for example, or you might lose 30 cents of your housing assistance if you're lucky enough to have that. So that really eats into it. So the earned income tax credit is a program we have that tries to counteract that. And the other thing that the UK did was raise the minimum wage.
There is one key difference between the U.S. and many of the other countries that you've cited that have a child allowance policy. A lot of those places started from a different place. I think of the U.K. They already had a social safety net, national health insurance, more comprehensive unemployment benefits, more affordable higher education. How does that change the equation for how effective a child allowance might be in alleviating child poverty in the U.S., which is worse off than many of those other places?
Well, I will say that this takes us the furthest in that direction of anything that we've done. In the United States, for example, we've had a lot of success around expanding access to health insurance for kids starting in the 1990s. But there's still a lot of times when they might drop off that public benefit. Their mom loses a job, and so they end up losing their health insurance. And, you know, this type of model, right, of the child allowance says, let's try to keep things simpler when we can. Let's fold in as many families as we can, provide them exactly the same benefit. So we are in a different starting point, but this is a move in that direction. The cash part of it actually takes a libertarian turn, right? And saying families know what they need the most, right? And so we're going to give them the resources they need to help their families in the way they know how.
One key detail here, Luke, the child allowance and the Biden stimulus package will only be in effect for 1 year. Are you worried about what happens after that?
Well, that's a question. I think this is one of those great opportunities where we can put this in place and we can see what Americans think about it. The Biden plan here in the United States is estimated by my colleagues at Columbia to reduce child poverty by 45%. That would be transformational.
Luke Schaefer is the Cone Professor of Policy and Director of Poverty Solutions at the University of Michigan. Luke, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This week, Switzerland passed a controversial referendum that bans face coverings by a razor-thin margin, 51 to 49%. That means the niqab and burqa worn by some Muslim women are now prohibited in public. The referendum was championed by the country's right-wing populist Swiss People's Party. Oscar Mazzolini has been following this closely. He's a professor of political science at the University of Lausanne. Let's dive a little deeper into that political system in Switzerland, this unique emphasis on direct democracy, referenda to legislate change. How have right-wing parties like the Swiss People's Party used that system to dominate discourse?
In the last 30 years, this party and in general right-wing populist party has been able to use direct democracy, referendum, and constitution initiatives in order to push their own issues in the national agenda. Immigration, of course, Islamic Muslims issues, of course, and European Union issues. So the relation between Switzerland and the European Union. And of course, this relevant role in shaping Swiss political agenda is also important in terms of electoral success. So this helps this party to increase also its achievement in parliamentary election and government election as well.
I mean, how is it being viewed, though, in Switzerland? Is it a sign that the influence of the far right is growing?
It's important to mention that some crucial policy orientation about immigration, about asylum seekers, has been oriented in a restricted way in the last 20 years. So Swiss policy modeling in this way are being influenced by the right-wing populist parties' mobilization. That's clear. Classic and on mainstream parties also share partially this opinion, this orientation. That's important to say also that this part, right-wing populist party, are a stable presence in Swiss politics now since the 90s. It started to push immigration and European Union relation as a central topics, a central issue in the 90s, and we stay here now again with these issues.
I mean, the Central Council of Muslims in Switzerland said of the vote that it sent a clear signal of exclusion to the Muslim minority. So there seems to be some major tension. How does this system of the direct democracy tradition actually square with the protection of minority groups?
It's a controversial point because direct democracy is an institution born as a protection for minorities. At the same time, direct democracy could be also a way by which majority imposed to the minority, of course. In this sense, create a tension. And in this case, it allowed to increase also the xenophobic also perception of some minorities, some migrant groups, etc. That's a sort of a contradictory effect of direct democracy at the moment.
Oscar Mazzolini is a professor of political science at the University of Lausanne in Switzerland, speaking with me about how a controversial referendum banning face coverings recently passed there. Professor, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. Hello, Marco here. This past year, listeners continued to show their unwavering support for The World. Together, we raised over $100,000, thanks to the following people that helped us reach our goal. Ty Cameron, James George, Micah Wagner, Jane Schmitz, Kerry Hoffman, Thafail Malake, Colin Hamilton, Megan Johnson, Linda Hill, and Tom Miller. Thank you all for helping us bring human-centered journalism to listeners all around the world. Microsoft has been hacked. The company says cyber criminals from China are to blame. It's just the latest in a series of worrisome cyber attacks aimed at U.S. targets. Security experts say we need better defense.
The most important thing that everyone should be doing is operating under the assumption that someone is already inside, what the industry calls assume breach mentality.
That story's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Tomorrow marks 10 years since this. About a quarter to three in the afternoon, the coast of northeast Japan got hit by a magnitude 9 earthquake. A tsunami then destroyed towns and cities up and down the coast. It also crashed into the Fukushima nuclear plant, resulting in a catastrophic meltdown that has scarred the region for a long, long time to come. Nearly 20,000 people died. More than 2,000 people are still missing. Many people simply left the region. The children and teenagers who experienced the quake and stayed they feature centrally in a new art project in Japan that commemorates the disaster. Two pairs of artists, Americans and Japanese, are behind the project. Hiroyuki Abe and Natsuka Endo in Tokyo, and Sue Mark and her husband Bruce Douglas from the San Francisco Bay Area. The four met in 2019.
We did not know each other at all. It was kind of like a blind date. A mutual friend of ours set us up on an artist adventure.
It was so miracle that a friend just called me and she said, I want to introduce interesting United States artist for you. Just a short conversation was the beginning.
That was Hiroyuki and Sue.
Because I and Sue and Bruce and Natsuka, four of us are also focusing on research-based art. It's like we could speak very easily about each other's art pieces.
But how do you begin to memorialize a disaster through art? It was a fundamental question for the four artists. At first, Hiroyuki wasn't sure it was something he even wanted to work on.
I felt difficult to focus on 311 disaster for my artwork.
He had memories.
I can remember it clearly. I was in Tokyo and I was in my house. And after eating lunch, suddenly strong and long earthquake happened. It hit me and it continued around 1 minute or 2 minutes. It's a very long earthquake. And I felt it's something very bad. But collaboration is quite important to face with the disaster. So my mind was changed. Because Sue can see the disaster from an outside eyes. I have the inside eyes, but Sue has outside eyes. So that's why we started collaboration.
As artists, you know, we're not sociologists or anthropologists. We're not historians and we're not academics. So we're always searching for a new kind of language and a new way for people to creatively express themselves.
Sue and Hiro are in Tokyo, and we met recently on Zoom to talk about what they and their partners created. It's a project that allows us to hear the voices of young Japanese people 10 years after the earthquake. The collaboration began before the pandemic. The artists had settled on a plan. They would collect thoughts from residents of the impacted Tohoku region of northeast Japan, reflections about the recovery since the earthquake, and people's hopes for the future.
We had been designing a special writing room on the back of a flatbed truck. We can be messengers to share people's stories and voices, but we did not want to repeat efforts that have already been done. There are amazing archives and documentation of people's stories from the event. We wanted to do something that was reflective of this point in time.
The idea was that the messages the artists gathered would travel on that truck and arrive in Tokyo to be shared with the spectators at the 2020 Olympics.
But of course, nothing went as planned and everything changed.
When COVID-19 hit, the four creators wanted to continue their work, but they faced a problem: how to meet people safely during a pandemic. Sue Mark again.
Morally, in doing this work, we could cause no harm. Maybe we could just have people meet at the truck, but that wasn't safe either. So really, the safest thing became, you know, using the mode of communication that we all use now to meet on, which is Zoom. And I think the beauty of it was that we were going to meet people through trusted relational networks, and we met people, we've been meeting people inside of their homes.
On Zoom.
On Zoom.
How did you engage these young people? What did you ask them?
We only asked them three questions. The process is very short. You know, what is on your mind right now? What are the sounds that bring you strength? And what does safety sound like to you?
What's on your mind right now?
Heiwa, Romeo to Juliet.
I think a lot about peace. I'm also thinking about Romeo and Juliet.
What sounds bring you strength?
たくさんの拍手の音.
The sound of enthusiastic applause uplifts my spirit.
One of the people that spoke to you, it was the gentle clicking sound of someone turning on the stove. Makes me feel safe. And the reason they said that was because they didn't have power right after the tsunami. So it's interesting how the present day is informed by the past.
Absolutely. And some people said to us they can't watch the news and hear sirens because it's just too traumatizing.
What's on your mind right now?
勉強、将来、復活。
What's on my mind right now? My ability to continue with my studies, to join in club activities, and what my future will be like after I finish school.
What's on your mind right now?
家族のことです。
I think about my family. I'm concerned for them, their well-being.
A number of the people spoke immediately about what's on their mind right now, about their family. What do you think that's about, especially during the pandemic?
I think it's a super important thing because even we are living in the same place, sometimes we cannot meet each other because of the pandemic. And I remember that after the 311 disaster, sometimes we felt very much afraid of going outside because of the nuclear power plant accident. But this time, another situation gives me heart to get out.
What's on your mind right now?
宮城の未来, 自分の将来のことについてです。
I'm concerned about the future of Miyagi Prefecture, and I'm worried about my own future here.
What towns bring you strength?
繁華街が賑わっていること。
The sound of a downtown area bustling with many people.
Gaya, gaya, gaya. The sound of hubbub. Interestingly, the voices that Sue and Hiro and their partners collected for this project will return to live in, for example, a city park.
We're creating a series of voiced tsunami stones.
Old stone warning markers along the Japanese coastline. As Hiroyuki Abe explains, they're taking something low-tech and bringing it alive with high-tech.
Historically, these tsunami stones are the key of warning. So the tsunami stones usually located on the hill, and it says, don't build a house down of that point. Instead of the silent tsunami stone, we want to use a speaking tsunami stone, and inside of the stones, we want to build small computers and speakers. And all electricity is powered from the solar panel, so it's green energy and all new generation tsunami stone.
Our plan is after our presentations this summer is to donate these voice monuments back to the regions from which the stories came. So we're starting to work on that process as well in conversation with some municipalities. And we've also started some relationships with the many disaster museums that have cropped up in the Tohoku region. We can carry these voices within ourselves and carry these messages of the young survivors, the young adults in the Tohoku region, and keep spreading them.
What towns bring you a sense of safety?
Listening to the voices of my friends and family around me laughing, as opposed to crying, makes me feel safe and secure.
Are people laughing again today?
Yes. I remember that just after the earthquake, no one was laughing. It was a very hard time for almost all Japanese to survive. But I remember that 2012, one year after the earthquake, people started to think about their future little by little, and they can feel easily. Laughing is a very important feeling to live in normal. So I think laughing is the key for checking recovery.
Hiroyuki Abe and Natsuka Endo, Sue Mark and Bruce Douglas will be presenting their work during an online symposium next week. The question that is launching the session is one that the people of Northeast Japan have been wrestling with for the last decade. And right now it seems apt for the whole world amid the pandemic. How do we begin again?
What towns bring you a sense of safety?
The sound of the wind chimes of Nambutekki.
The earthquake and tsunami in Japan 10 years ago flattened parts of Ishinomaki, Residents there say the town disappeared. Their story is tomorrow in our continuing coverage of the Fukushima disaster a decade later. Conversations about race and identity have gripped the UK this week, beginning Monday morning after Oprah's interview with Prince Harry and Meghan Markle, and revelations about offensive behavior from the royal family. Feeling not British enough or othered is an experience many immigrants say they face in the UK, and echoed across many professions. Now some in the music industry are calling for change. The world's Bianca Hillier has that story.
Rina Sawayama's self-titled debut album hit the scene with a bang. The lead single, titled STFU, is a heavy metal rager with clear notes of early 2000s nostalgia. But skip to the album's next song, and you'll hear something totally different. Here, the artist offers a pulsating club track made for the dance floor. This kind of range continues throughout the album. It quickly became a hit with critics, fired up an international fan base, and even got a shout out from Elton John.
So far, you have made my album of the year. This is my favorite album of the year. It's a phenomenal,
no way.
Phenomenal record.
So when award season came around, 30-year-old Rina Sawayama was expected to win big. But the nominations never came because Rina was deemed not British enough to be eligible.
Oh, it was just really heartbreaking, you know.
Rina told the BBC that to enter two of the biggest awards, the Brits and the Mercury Prize, solo artists have to be UK citizens. Rina has spent 26 years in the UK, but she was born in Japan, a country that doesn't allow dual citizenship. She says this ineligibility is the latest fight in a seemingly endless battle to become British.
I think a lot of immigrants feel this way, where they assimilate and they become part of the British culture, and to be told that we're not even eligible to be nominated or to be on the same standing as everyone else to be judged for our work is, you know, it's very othering.
Jazz musician Sarathi Korwar knows the feeling well. He moved from Pune, India to London in 2009 and says he's experienced hypocrisy within the music industry there.
There's many instances where London being such a multicultural, diverse city, you're made to feel very comfortable in your own skin. But then there's times where suddenly, when it comes down to the platform of awarding musicians for their work, you're not deemed worthy of even being considered.
Sarathi found out about the citizenship rules when his own album came out in 2019. Songs like this one, City of Words, got rave reviews. But just like Rina, Sarathi couldn't be nominated because he isn't a UK citizen. What's at stake, he says, is more than a trophy.
You know, it's the platform of being seen. Like, the Mercury Prize is a very, very well-reputed award. And if you see people who look like you or sound like you or in any way resemble your lived experience, obviously that's going to be very empowering for another generation of people who have never been able to see those kind of role models.
Rina Sawayama decided to take this battle head on. She spoke out in a widely shared Vice article and eventually landed a meeting with the British Phonographic Industry, or BPI, who organizes the Mercury and Brit Awards. Soon, her fans around the world, who call themselves Pixels, we're on board.
Telling her she's not British enough is just insane.
Cheval Hassan is a 21-year-old from Tel Aviv, Israel. She's one of the thousands of fans who joined an online campaign using the hashtag Sawayama is British.
Because she is British, like most of the album was recorded in London and it was produced by British producers. The record label is also British.
For fans like Cheval, excluding Rina from these awards felt personal. The album in question, Sawayama, came out just as the pandemic was beginning. I'm losing myself in the darkness of the world. Catch me before I fall. Cheval says songs like this one, Dynasty, carried her through the roller coaster of 2020.
That album really touched me in a way that no other album has ever touched me. And I felt understood. I felt safe while listening to this album. And she gave me this, so I'm forever grateful for that.
Devoted fans spent months lobbying for Rina's inclusion. Rina herself continued speaking to the press. months went by. Then the news broke.
The singer, who has lived in the UK for 26 years, has now won the right to compete.
The BPI listened and announced new eligibility rules for the Mercury and Brit Awards. Artists are now eligible if they've lived in the UK for at least 5 years. Citizenship is no longer required. Rena responded to the news on the BBC.
I'm floored and I'm so happy. Breaking down barriers is a really important thing alongside representation, and I really focus with my work and my music and everything to try and bring those down so that people, you know, after me, future generations can feel British.
The new rules mean that jazz artist Sarathi Korwar is now eligible too. He says he's glad the BPI made these changes, but the months of energy Rena had to spend to get there is an example of the burden that minorities often bear.
Half the time, if not more than half the time, you're spending your creative energy just trying to kind of fight those battles rather than actually make the music that you want to make.
Sarathi added that at least current artists and future generations now know change is possible, and that perhaps other award shows facing similar demands should take note. More. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Get your mid-morning global news fix with our daily newsletter, Top of the World. The main headlines of the day and some stories you might have missed. Subscribe by heading to theworld.org/newsletters. Modern espionage or acts of war? How should we view state-sponsored hacks against American targets? Last week we learned of another one. This time hackers went after Microsoft's email service. Security experts are pointing the finger at China. Dmitry Alperovich has been following this. He's a co-founder of the cybersecurity firm CrowdStrike and now heads a think tank called Silverado Policy Accelerator. Describe this latest Microsoft hack for us, Dmitry. What do we know so far?
So it started out as an espionage operations where one particular Chinese nation state group has gone after these email servers that companies have on premise. From Microsoft, they found four different vulnerabilities that they were able to use to get on those email servers and steal emails directly from those networks. And it continued to be for a few months as this very targeted, very stealth operation until a couple of weeks ago when somehow, we don't know yet how, they got wind that Microsoft was going to put out a patch for these vulnerabilities and essentially shut down their access to new victims once those victims would apply the patch. And at that point, they did something that is unprecedented for them, which is decided to scan literally the entire internet for every single vulnerable Microsoft Exchange server and promptly compromise that Exchange server so that later on they can sift through this big net that they've cast and determine what they caught and what victims they actually want to continue stealing data from. And unfortunately, by doing that, they made everyone else in the world vulnerable, not just to their own activities, the Chinese, I mean, but also to others that could use that access to compromise those networks and do something that is actually more destructive, like deploy ransomware that can lock up the entire network and then demand a huge ransom from the company to get their data back.
So according to recent reports, this hack hit at least 30,000 victims in the U.S. alone. What kind of leverage or information are hackers looking for in these types of attacks? And was this one any different?
So from the Chinese perspective, they're really looking for national security and economic espionage targets. So stealing documents from dissident groups, identifying people within China that they think are trying to undermine the regime from their standpoint. They're trying to steal intellectual property from Western companies to give it to their own state-owned enterprises. That's what the Chinese typically do. But now that the vulnerability is much more widely in use by other threat actors, of course, you've got criminal groups. They're breaking into these companies and trying to steal financial data. And the thing that everyone is really worried about, the next shoe to drop here, is the ransomware gangs getting into the game and doing really destructive attacks.
How have Microsoft and the U.S. government responded?
Well, Microsoft put out the patches, and they've put out a number of different security tools that people can use to scan to see if they've already been compromised. The U.S. government has been amplifying the message that people should be patching. They should be doing a lot to secure their infrastructure. So that's about as much as we can do at the moment. Unfortunately, we need to do more to try to deter this behavior. And I think this is an opportunity for us to define some norms.
So going back to what I said earlier, Dimitri, are these hacks espionage or acts of war? And how do you even go about making that distinction? Like, parse out why you consider the SolarWinds hack espionage and this hack perhaps more of an attack.
Well, I don't think either of them are acts of war. I think we need to be very careful about the use of that language. We need to be clear, no one is dying. No infrastructure is getting physically destroyed, at least not yet. So I don't believe that they're acts of war. Certainly not the SolarWinds operation, which I think falls squarely in the traditional espionage bucket. The very type of operation that we in the U.S. government would be proud of doing to our own adversaries.
And why does it look or seem to you like espionage, just briefly?
Because the main targets are government agencies. It's Department of Justice, it's Department of Treasury, our Nuclear Safety Administration, and others that you'd expect the Russians to want to get access to. And we would want to get access into the networks of the agencies that are the counterparts to ours in Russia and China and other places. So that's just what countries do. They spy on each other. The Chinese one, I think, is very different because of the reckless nature of how they went about it. And they didn't just hit the targets that they cared about from a national security perspective, but they also literally hit everyone on the planet that had a vulnerable exchange server, and that activity needs to be curtailed.
Is there anything governments or companies can do to prevent further cyber breaches?
Absolutely. The most important thing that everyone should be doing is operating under the assumption that someone is already inside, what the industry calls assume breach mentality. A capable attacker will be able to find their way into even a very secure network. But it doesn't mean that that's game over. If you're looking for them, if you're responding quickly to their activities inside the network, that's when you can get an advantage and when you can prevent them from doing any damage.
Dimitri Alperovich heads the think tank Silverado Policy Accelerator. Really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
We've got vaccines. Several of them have been tested. They work well, and they're approved by regulators. Now it's up to governments around the world to get those shots into people's arms. We're finding out how that comes with certain challenges. Making the vaccines accessible to everyone means overcoming barriers faced by some groups of people. In Britain, Dr. Sharon Raymond is getting creative. She runs a program called Vaxi Taxi.
People have logistical barriers to accessing vaccination. Not everyone has private transport. Some people have been shielding for a long time and are worried about taking public transport, and that's where the Vaxi Taxis come in.
The Vaxi Taxi will swing by to pick you up and take you to get your shot. End-to-end service.
Are you right-handed or left-handed? So I put in your left shoulder.
That's a vaccine being given inside one of the vehicles. It works for dense urban areas like London. In rural Ghana, there's another innovation. Officials there are taking the vaccination program into the air.
Spinning motors. One, two, one.
Vaccine delivery by drone. The drone takes off from a long silver ramp at a base in Ghana. Health officials in the country have been using U.S. drone technology for a few years now. But in the midst of a pandemic, drones about the length of a bicycle are loaded with a box carrying coronavirus vaccines, and those are dropped by parachute for medical clinics in Ghana's more remote areas. Remote is the key word for some communities in sub-zero Arctic Alaska. Nurses packing vaccines have just a few hours of daylight to reach people in remote locations, including some Native American tribes. Nurse James Austin recently told ABC about a vaccination trip into the tundra.
We got to go from car to commercial airline bearing air, got picked up at a snowgo with a sled behind it. Then we got picked up by a four-wheeler with a little trailer behind it. More snowgos, more sled.
A snowgo, by the way, is like a bicycle, but it's got two short skis instead of wheels. That could be an unprecedented way of getting people shots. It just takes a little creativity to make it work. Speaking of work, our work here is done for the day. The world comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You stay safe, be strong. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.